Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guests are Dorothy Cotton and Kirby Edmonds. Dr. Dorothy Cotton is an activist, lecturer, educator, and writer. She was the education director for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference from 1960 to 1968. She worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders, directing the Citizenship Education Program. Later, Dr. Cotton served as vice president for field operations for the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change in Atlanta. She is currently the inspiration behind the Dorothy Cotton Institute, a project of the Center for Transformative Action. The Dorothy Cotton Institute is an internationally renowned education and resource center which develops, trains, and nurtures leaders for a global human rights movement. And Kirby Edmonds is the program coordinator as well as a senior fellow for the Dorothy Cotton Institute. He manages and delivers programs on human rights education to public school educators and community youth workers. He also develops programs on civic engagement. Outside of the Cotton Institute, he is the managing partner for TFC Associates, that's Training for Change Associates, a human relations and consulting firm based in Ithaca, New York. And welcome to the show to you both.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you here. Now, I want to begin with you, Dorothy. Tell us how you met Dr. King and how you got involved in the civil rights movement.
Oh, my goodness. First, I want to change something or add it a little bit from the introduction that you just gave. Thank you very much. I know it is written in some places. Many people assume that that I left the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is what SCLC stands for. And if it goes into the history books that I left in 1968, that means I left as soon as Dr. King was killed, was assassinated. I stayed with SCLC almost 4 years after Dr. King's assassination. I didn't leave in 68, the year he was assassinated.
Well, I'm glad you cleared that up.
So I do want to say that. But how I met Dr. King, it's rather challenging to talk about that in terms of the moment of meeting him. I think we have to look at, from a broader perspective, the situation, the culture in our country at the time. And I'm talking about what I call our American-style apartheid, that rigid separation of the races. I was aware of that when I was a child. And I've written about this, and I've told this story in more than one place. That is, here's an incident that sort of pinpoints it for me. I think I was not more than 10 years old. When I saw a little white boy, and I hate those terms referring to people by those words of color, but I heard this little boy riding his bicycle down my dusty street, and even that, there was a story in that, because the pavement stopped after it got through the white section, and when it got through where the folk that looked like us, you know, African-American people, there was no pavement. So he's riding his bicycle down the street, and he was singing, doing a paraphrase of an old song, Deep in the Heart of Texas is the original song. He was singing Deep in the Heart of Niggertown, Deep in the Heart of Niggertown. I remember at about 10 years old that I really smarted behind that. I was really angry because I already knew that word, you know, the N word as it's supposedly nicely referred to now. I knew what that word suggested, that we African Americans were less than other people. So what I'm saying is that the movement towards understanding that there was something not right in our country was an evolving process. It was an evolving event. And so we can fast forward to be specific to your question as to when I met Dr. King. I became very active in a church in Petersburg, Virginia, where I was living when I did meet Dr. King. And the minister at my church, Reverend Dr. Wyatt T. Walker, incidentally, he did his Ph.D. in African-American music. But my point is, though he pastored a church, Reverend Dr. Walker was also the head of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. There are some people out there who don't know what that stands for. And also CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. He was and pastor of the church. Well, he met this preacher, Martin Luther King Jr., at a conference and at the Virginia Union University, and they became friends. African-American people could not use the public library in Petersburg, Virginia. And Dr. Walker, pastor of the church, NAACP, Congress of Racial Equality, running all those operations, he invited this little preacher that he met at this conference, Martin Luther King Jr. They became friends. And when we were struggling against the exclusion of black folk from the public library, Reverend Dr. Walker invited him to come up and speak for us in Petersburg, Virginia, as, wow. because we were mounting a movement against exclusion of black folks from the public library. So that boycotting stores downtown, we were doing a lot of things to call attention to the powers that be, to the fact that we were struggling against the exclusion of black folk from the public library, if you can believe that.
Oh, I can believe it. The history of this country is unbelievable. Yeah.
I just found a letter that I signed as secretary to the Petersburg Improvement Association. We had an organization where we were, Reverend Walker was petitioning the city council to open the public library so we too could use the public library. Now, specific again to your question, when Martin Luther King came up to speak for us, now he had already led the Montgomery bus boycott, but he did not start that movement.
I was going to ask
Rosa
you what
Parks
year this was.
Was the catalyst for
Absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah.
But he's quick to say in his first book that he did not start the Montgomery bus boycott. I'll talk about it some more later, I hope, and that is that. People find it very difficult to understand that Dr. King didn't start the movement, and he didn't even lead it in a lot of places, but he emerged as this powerful voice that sort of brought it all together.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop there unless you... I hope I answered your question.
Absolutely.
But when he came to speak for us, that's when I met him.
Yes. Okay. Well, I understand that history, too, and thank you for sharing that with us. Kirby, I want to talk to you about... You're a little bit of the younger generation than Dorothy. What kind of inspiration have you acquired from Dr. King and Dorothy Cotton's legacies?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I first heard Dr. King speak live August in 1963. I was 12 years old. I was there. I don't know if I would say my inspiration in the context of civil rights comes from any particular person other than my parents. My first experience with claiming my own power was when I was 9 years old and refused to leave a soda fountain in Texas.
So you were brought up in Texas?
Oh, no, I was visiting Texas.
Oh, you were visiting Texas.
So I started having my sit-ins before I knew there were any sit-ins. And I think that my inspiration starts with what Dorothy actually started her conversation with, which is a sense of what is right relationship with other people. And a fairly profound recognition of what is wrong relationship and a sense of responsibility to not participate in wrong relationship if I can avoid it.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And I think for many young people, the challenge for them is what happens to that impulse towards right relationship and whether it is encouraged and supported by the adults around them or whether they get punished for that experience, as it appears to me that all young people have it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Have you always believed in nonviolence, or was that something that had to gel inside you?
Oh, I never heard the term, I don't think, early on. When the little boy was riding down my street, I was angry, but again, I was a child. I was actually introduced to nonviolence as I began to feel in me or sense an interest in this little Indian guy called Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh, yes.
I was picking up little threads of what he was teaching, what he was about, the goal being to just break the bonds that tied India to Britain. And I'm very conscious of becoming interested in the teaching of Mahatma Gandhi. But when Dr. King came up to speak for us in Virginia, because of the protest movement that we had going there, and it was just mushrooming, not only in Petersburg, I think it's where I was living, I think it's important to point out that protest activity was springing up in a lot of places. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's very interesting to me even now. And I love that word, the zeitgeist was upon us. The spirit of the times was upon us. So in many cities, there was protest activity going on. Rosa Parks refusing to move to the back of the bus it got the most coverage. But protest activity was springing up in a lot of places because I love the way Kirby puts it, that people were conscious of not having right relationships and that we deserve to have right relationships. And we moved to a place of deciding that we were going to struggle to tear down the barriers that kept us from having right relationships with everybody. But we have a lot of work to do. That fast forward for just a second here, I will just quickly refer to the Citizenship Education Program, which was my major responsibility, my title being Director of Education for Dr. King's organization. The focus of my work was to run workshops that carried the name of Citizenship Education. I like to say, Andrew Young, my partner in that work, like to say what we did in the citizenship education work was to unbrainwash, especially African-American people. Because if the culture is structured in a way that says at every turn that one is less than other people, eventually the people who are treated that way can begin to internalize that sense of themselves.
Absolutely.
And so, and this is how I picked up this phrase from Andy, my coworker in this work. He said, our job was to unbrainwash black folks because where we had lived into this pattern of, I call it American-style apartheid. We had lived into this pattern. And again, I jump back again to Mahatma Gandhi, who said, the Brits didn't take India from us. We gave it to them.
Yeah.
And I played a video, and they actually had footage of the Mahatma Gandhi walking with people on the Salt March to the sea.
Gandhi,
that's what we did.
He influenced so many people. I read his books when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I got involved
in the
grape boycott in California with Cesar Chavez and got into Joan Baez, who was into nonviolence. And
So I was very influenced by
that as well. That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
Now, talk to us about the fact that you were the only woman in Dr. King's main circle. I mean, that's what I have heard. And was it because of sexism, inherent sexism? I mean,
there might have been some of that, but
it's curious.
The modern day women's movement didn't start until the 1970s.
That's right.
Got that.
That's right.
Until the 70s.
71.
I went to work with Dr. King in 1960.
But did you feel that you were discriminated against because you were a woman?
I don't want to lift that up that way as a hard and fast rule.
Yeah.
If we have a culture where women, I'll give you an example. Maybe we can come up with the right term that describes it here. But I'm at the table with the executive staff meeting, and with all these men, true. But I'm the director of education, not for the citizenship education program alone, but for the organization. If we needed a training in anything, I already had a master's degree in special education when I went from Boston University when I went to work with Dr. King. But sitting around that table, being the only woman, if they needed a cup of coffee, guess who they asked to get the coffee? The woman at the table was supposed to do that.
That's right.
Even taking notes. The woman was the secretary. Nothing beyond that. And that was something, fast forward to the 70s, the women's movement, when women struggled against being relegated to just that category of work.
But they
asked me to get the coffee. They asked me to take the notes until a man, Jack O'Dell was his name, who, when I was asked to go get the coffee, it was Jack who said, Dr. King, Dorothy needs to stay in this meeting because we're discussing what we need to do in, I forget, whatever city it was. And that's what we were planning at that moment or discussing. So they called one of the, not to put down the administrative people or secretaries, but to call somebody and ask them to bring in some coffee. But they asked me to go get it. So I'm just saying there were little hints.
Absolutely,
but guess what?
Yeah.
I didn't struggle against that so much at that time because we couldn't fight sexism and racism at the same time.
Oh, I understand that. I was just wondering what you felt about that.
Yeah, we couldn't. It took a while.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dorothy Cotton and Kirby Edmonds. They are human rights activists and part of the Dorothy Cotton Institute, which I do want to talk about before we run out of time. Who wants to start? Tell us how this evolved.
Well, Kirby, I have a story about that. Anke Wessels, I told you she was in the shower. And she said she had this idea. It wasn't the Institute at that time, but somebody brought her over to see me, and we sat around my kitchen table. That's the first I heard of what I consider the beginning, and you take it from there, but that's the first time I heard of organizing something in my name.
Anke Wessels is the executive director of the Center for Transformative Action, and she was inspired enough by Dorothy and meeting with her, who I believe she was introduced to Dorothy by Margot Hittleman, who's also a senior fellow, and thought that the center should do something in Dorothy's honor. And her thought was to have one or two students, probably at Cornell, be Dorothy Cotton fellows. So she and Dorothy basically started having colleagues of Dorothy's start meeting in Dorothy's living room to talk about how we might make such a thing happen. And the question began to be framed as, Dorothy, what do you want your legacy to be? And after about 2 hours of conversation, Laura Branca, who was also a senior fellow, said, we're not talking about a couple of fellows. We're actually talking about an institute. And we're talking about an institute with the goal of transforming the conversation we're having globally about how we live together. And that was the inception of a lot of thinking about how to make such a thing happen.
And that meshed directly with what I felt inside of me. It was like divine intervention, Kirby, that would happen when I was wondering, what will happen to a room full of books and papers and all of that, and this just came on the scene.
So are you, in fact, housing all of your materials from your life
in
the
Institute? It's all in the house now. The Institute, they have it. It's will to the Institute. If I go on to the great beyond before some other people, it belongs to the Institute.
That's wonderful. Yeah. But what else is the Institute doing? You're doing training. You're trying to train leaders.
Well, our vision is rooted in the notion that what's needed is a global unifying movement. Actually, such a movement exists. One of the problems we have globally is that the United States, which has such tremendous influence over what happens on the rest of the globe, is actually out of touch with that global movement. And the global movement has to do with human rights and social justice. In other parts of the world, it's framed as human rights pretty directly. And in the United States, as we've discovered working with educators just trying to talk about human rights, either people don't understand what the global human rights framework is at all, or they have a very limited view of human rights as being about civil and political rights, and have the view, therefore, that the United States is way ahead of the rest of the planet, and that essentially we're done.
That's actually shocking.
The work of the Dorothy Cotton Institute is global in the sense of putting our shoulders to the wheel of creating a planet that actually is able to exercise full human rights for all of us, but more specifically really addressing the deficits in the United States about our understanding of what human rights might mean and our understanding of how it ought to affect both our behavior and our social policy. So one really big example is that the human rights framework includes economic rights, and the United States barely recognizes economic rights as being real, which is what the conversation of the last 3 years has been about. That's what the Occupy movement
is
about.
That's
what the discussion, however it gets framed from whatever point of view, about who does Barack Obama represent, when his rhetoric is about economic rights, you will notice that one of the negative responses is we're talking about socialism.
Right.
So we have a debate in this nation that actually frames a discussion of economic rights as being close to the devil. Now, that's insane.
And it has become into the forefront.
When we talk about the vision of the Dorothy Cotton Institute, it is larger than an organization. We certainly don't understand ourselves to be in charge of or leading anything. In some ways, it is putting our shoulders to the wheel of a movement that has been going on at least for the last couple thousand years.
Do you see the Dorothy Cotton Institute as something akin to Amnesty International, but in a different way?
Amnesty International, akin to, certainly because Amnesty International is one of the 2 million organizations on the planet that really is devoted to human rights.
Right.
So in that sense, absolutely, as we are linked to all of the other organizations doing the same kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I would say that's really different is an understanding that one of the things that's needed is a language for people who are working on various aspects of human rights to understand themselves to be working on the same thing.
Mm.
So Dorothy, for example, said we couldn't do civil rights and women's rights at the same time. And I think she was right. That was true. But we can now.
We can now.
Mm-hmm. We can now.
I agree.
Partly because that has happened,
yes.
We can now.
Uh-huh.
But that's going to have to be a decision. People, for example, who are working on environmental rights, if they understand themselves to be in exactly the same struggle as people working on civil rights, as people working on child rights, as people working on animal rights, as people mm-hmm. working on women's rights, it is the same struggle because it has to do with committing ourselves to a framework for how we will actually be together on this planet and putting the ideal of what it means to be human in the forefront of what we hold ourselves accountable to.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the work of the Dorothy Cotton Institute.
That's a wonderful mission, absolutely wonderful mission. But how does it manifest itself? Are you coming up with education? You know, in the concrete world, it sounds incredible, but are you coming up with educational tools to change minds?
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
We'll see if the minds change.
Yes.
So far, I would say we've been... one thing to understand is we've actually only been doing programming for just over a year.
I know. It is a very young organization.
And we've had a direct impact on close to 300 educators throughout the community. That work is expanding.
Mm-hmm.
We've already had a fairly direct impact on the building of a national network of human rights educators.
So you're going to wait and see how it evolves.
So around the question of, you know, what's the impact been and are we being successful, I think it's too early to say.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we've done enough at this point to really know what the path looks like.
Mm.
Around the issue of are we developing materials, yes. But actually, we are trying more to find materials that already exist and make sure people use them.
Ah. Dorothy, what would you want your legacy to be? Have you thought about that? I mean, in concrete terms?
I'm not sure I've thought about it in concrete terms, other than to say and to acknowledge that I want to have made a difference. I want to have helped us on the planet globally, and I've traveled in a lot of countries.
Mm-hmm.
We all have been to other countries as well. So I think we can never alone live really separate from each other.
Mm.
So to see our connectedness with each other, I hope that I was in Japan once and at an FOR, Fellowship of Reconciliation Conference, and there were people there from about 30 different countries. And I remember asking them when it was my time to speak how many of them had heard the theme song from our movement here, the civil rights movement, We Shall Overcome.
Uh-huh.
And all these hands went up. And I had each group sing We Shall Overcome in their own language separately.
Wow.
And then I had them all sing it together. And I thought about something that Paul Robeson said, when we learn to sing each other's songs, we will then know how to live together. So I was fascinated by that concept. First, I heard Harry Belafonte quote Paul Robeson first. And then I played a tape of Robeson and heard him say that because he lived in other countries.
Uh-huh.
And so anything that we can do to help us move towards understanding that we must live together on this planet or we will perish together. And I want to go back to something. Kirby, you reminded me of what you just said of the fact that I think I have learned that we have evolved to a place or from a place where we really thought at the time that we couldn't, because the men would have thought we were attacking them. That was the consciousness then.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
why I say we couldn't work on women's rights and couldn't fight against the sexism and what's the term that you used earlier? We couldn't fight against men.
Sexism was the word I...
Yeah, sexism.
Yeah.
They really would have thought we were attacking them. Sometimes one has to just strategically know, I want to be at this table where the decisions are made. And I can fight with them about wanting me to get the coffee another time, but I'm going to stay at this table. So,
that's great.
So I think in everything that
uh-huh.
we do, we evolve. Nothing is static. I worry about that because sometimes people even you know, so, well, not, attack is too strong a word, but Dr. King, for some language that he used. For example, he'll say men when he means people.
Oh, yeah, mankind.
And if he were around now, he would say people. He wouldn't say men when he's talking about people, because we had not evolved to a place where we use that language more appropriately.
Exactly.
That's what we said then when we talked, when the preachers would say men, you know, it's very, I don't know, is sexist the word? But he would have evolved. That's what I want to give us permission to understand, that we do evolve from one understanding.
Exactly. The world evolves.
Of the language to another understanding.
That's right.
I smart under the fact that anyone would still say now men when they mean people.
Exactly. Exactly. I know. The world evolves. People change.
And we
people
all evolve.
Change
people
the world.
Change. Right.
It's all
right.
a
but
cycle.
At that time, that's what we had to do. Otherwise, we would have had that fight rather than. We didn't have the sophistication to do both at the same time.
Yeah. We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you both this, if you can talk to me very quickly. How much of an influence do you think President Obama has had on this culture in regard to his historical win and leadership skills?
I'll say one sentence. I think that he's had a fantastic impact, but I think the folk who understand that are not yelling and screaming at each other like the people who oppose him. To have somebody run a campaign and their only platform is get rid of Obama, there's something wrong with that picture, and I think people are seeing that. I don't know, but I have a feeling people are seeing that that's their only goal, to get rid of Obama. And that's how you're going to run the country, by kicking Obama out. That's all they're talking about. They actually, all of them say that, just get rid of Obama.
Yeah.
They never talk about what he inherited, you know, the incredible challenges that he faced. They never talk about that. They can't give him that. It's almost to the point of a sickness.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have anything to say about that, Kirby? Obama's influence on our culture at this point?
Yes. I don't know that I can describe what I think his personal influence is. The phenomenon around his running for president and getting elected, I think, represents something that is extremely meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And the debates that the nation has been in as he was campaigning and after he got elected frame for us some very critical turning points.
Mm-hmm.
We are presented with a decision as a nation about who we are going to be in a way that a white president cannot do. And the election of Obama basically puts in front of the nation in a way it cannot address any other way how it is going to be as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is that we collectively have not decided. And there are forces that really would rather have us live in the 1700s.
Yeah.
And there are forces that really would rather have us move into real social maturity as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And those forces are in conflict.
Yeah.
And I think Obama represents those forces.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he got elected is hopeful, because it indicates that the tide actually might move us towards social maturity.
Hmm. That's great. That's great. Well, we have run out of time. Kirby Edmonds and Dorothy Cotton, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate this. And can you give some contact information for the Dorothy Cotton, I keep saying...
Dorothy Cotton Institute.
Institute. I just want you to say something on the air. People.
So the website is the dorothycottoninstitute.org. As program coordinator, I can be reached at 607-277-3401 or tfckirby@aol.com.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.